Everybody, welcome to Two Off the First. It's Friday, October the 27th, 2023. I'm Ryan Bellinger. It's good to have you here. Hopefully you're ready for a great weekend. For some of you, probably include some Halloween prep, especially if you've got kids. Might be buying some candy. One of the best days of the year, frankly, is November 1st when they slash the prices of candy. It's one of the best days of the year. I mean, I don't even eat a lot of candy, but all the candy you would have in a year, you get basically the day after Halloween. It's tremendous. But we've got plenty to talk about here today. We're going to talk about a couple of different stories. One involves Bryson DeChambeau, but does not involve Liv. And then the other involves the LPGA. And some good news there. So let's start with the Bryson DeChambeau news. And this came courtesy of D Magazine earlier in the week. And I don't think many people saw this because I didn't see it until yesterday and came to my attention to golf Twitter yesterday. D Magazine, I believe, is Dallas-based, like D for Dallas. And this guy, Ben Swanger, wrote this piece on the 23rd. And the headline is, group headline by Bryson DeChambeau to launch top golf competitor under Par Life. And then the kind of sub-headline, the company's first venue is slated for construction on Hawks Creek Golf Course just west of Fort Worth and will break ground before the end of the year. So this idea, under Par Life, is kind of backed in part. I have no idea what part. I haven't seen the LLC docs. I have no idea about his equity size. Could be 0.5%, could be 50%. Don't know. But he's got an equity stake in this. He is a co-founder. And the idea of this is, as the headline alludes to, is meant to be a top golf competitor. However, it's supposed to be a little bit different, I guess, than Top Golf in a couple of ways. The primary difference, at least as far as the co-founder David Deering, who used to be with Adams Golf and other, has been in the world of startups forever, apparently, he says it's really meant to be for a better player, to try to capture that person and their attention as a driving range and practice facility. And the place is supposed to have 42 hitting bays, a 500-yard driving range. Who needs that? Three bars, a kitchen led by a celebrity chef named Christian Lehrman, a golf instruction academy, a fitness area, and a, quote, tour-level short game practice area. And they have signed a 99-year lease for this space at Hawks Creek, which is a city-owned property. And they expect the groundbreaking to start before the end of the year, and then it'll take 12 to 18 months to construct. So we're talking sometime, you know, spring 25-ish, probably, when this thing opens, when they have the whole big ceremony about it. And I don't bring this to you because of this, like the concept of under par life. Like the idea of jazzing up driving ranges is not new. Topgolf really was the first to do it, and they're still the kings of it. They have swatted down any potential competition that there is, and there's a bunch. This under par life concept is like the fifth or sixth that I'm aware of, and there are probably some I'm not aware of that have tried to take on Topgolf in some fashion. There's Big Shots, there's Golf Suite, there's Drive Shack, there's This Thing, there's one other that I'm forgetting that I used to know the name of. I mean, that's four right there. I'm sure there's a couple others I don't even know about yet. And none of them have proven even remotely successful compared to Topgolf. Drive Shack is a company. American Golf bought it, the company that, not American Golf, the people overseas that actually, they're a golf retailer overseas in like the UK. American Golf, the company that's the course operator. They bought Drive Shack. Drive Shack went into the ground. I mean, it's still active, still open and functions. I think they have four or five locations. But the stock itself got delisted from the New York Stock Exchange or the NASDAQ or whatever it was on because it couldn't sustain a price over a dollar a share. So now it's effectively a penny stock. Then you've got Golf Suites, which is its own thing and has, you know, three or four locations, and they sell shares privately, and they just artificially raise the price. Like, oh, the price of a share is now $10.25 or what, you know, whatever it is. There's no reason for that to go up. They don't let the market decide. They just tell you, if you want to buy, here it is. And if they want to dilute, they're going to dilute, kind of thing. Big Shots, similar kind of idea. Management company owned. I think Troon's involved with that one. I don't remember exactly. But again, none of these have proven to be able to scale in the way that Topgolf has. Topgolf was first to move in to this market. They created this concept overseas in the UK, brought it here. It got re-envisioned by American investors and or American-led investors, you know, and blossomed into this just cash cow concept. And that really hasn't worked out for any of these other competitors. They're like, oh yeah, we could do this. It's hard to do. It's hard to build a brand. Even if you do something like this right, you may only have a local or regional presence at best. So all of that to say, what Bryson DeChambeau says next in this piece should be found hilarious. Here's what he says. Quote, expense is a barrier to most things in life. It is an unusually high barrier to experience the joy of golf. Under par life at Hawks Creek is the first of many locations designed to redefine access to golf by reducing cost barriers. Our initiatives are geared toward making golf more affordable, approachable, and enjoyable for everyone. Our approach, partnering with municipally owned golf courses, removes significant financial obstacles and allows us to grow the community of golfers, end quote. Now, all that is absolute BS. That is one, I cannot stress enough how much BS is in that statement. The only thing that's true there is that it's going to cost less to have this at a muni as opposed to on private soil because they have signed a 99-year lease. So effectively, they're going to be the range operator for this golf course, Hawks Creek. And if that's their business model, then their hope is we will do the construction costs of building the range and making it look better. And then they don't have to buy the land. They don't have to develop the land. They're trying to take the cost off themselves. It's almost a form of projection going, you know, building these Topgolfs is really expensive because it is. I mean, it used to cost like $20 million, probably with all the inflation out there in the world, $30, $40, $50 million, depending on the one that you choose to build, depending on the site. And this is going to cost somewhat less than that because the land acquisition goes down, although really the material costs are what get you. And they want to try to frame this as some kind of idea of making golf cost less. Well, the expense of golf can vary pretty wildly. I mean, you can go play a municipal golf course for $25, $35 for 18 holes. You can go play a 9-hole golf course right down the street from here, from my home. I live about a mile-ish from a muni, one of our county-owned munis that are great. They have a 9-hole inner nine with threes, fours, and fives, 1-5. It's $15-$20. I mean, you can go play a full 9-hole round on a pretty nice golf course. You go play a par three course for even less elsewhere in the county. So the idea, and we live, by the way, in Montgomery County, Maryland, which is one of the wealthiest counties in the entire country, and you can do that. So please do not tell me that golf is extremely expensive and that's a huge barrier to entry. Besides the fact that driving ranges provide a great, easy to step over threshold to enter the game of golf. That's where I learned golf. I learned golf when I would go to BWI BWI driving range, which is near the BWI airport, and I would go hit in the batting cages back when I played baseball. And then after that, I would go hit golf balls. I'd get, you know, a large bucket or a jumbo bucket. They give me one of their crappy drivers that they had, that they rented out to people. And I just beat a driver 100 times until I realized I really liked it and I wanted to be helped by somebody. And the driving range pro gave me 4 lessons. And my mom went to Play It Again Sports and bought me a set of Dunlop irons. And the set of Dunlop irons didn't even have all the irons. It was 3, 5, 7, and 9. Didn't even have a pitching wedge. And that was how I learned to play golf. I still have the sleeve of Dunlop golf balls that range pro gave me for completing the lessons. And that sticks with me. It really does stick with me. So the way I learned golf, even initially, was a low cost, low barrier to entry. I grew up playing golf at a place called Carroll Park in Baltimore. It's a 12-hole facility at the time. It's now 9. They closed. It was 9, then became 12, then went back to 9. It's a city-owned golf course in Baltimore, right off the I-95. I learned playing there. I also learned playing on a military golf course in Anne Arundel County at Fort Meade. Incredible, incredible opportunity to play there. So what Bryson's saying here is a load of baloney. It is not an unusually high barrier to experience the joy of golf, as he says. You can grab a putter and a ball and go to a municipal golf course for $0 and practice putting. For less than $10, you can hit golf balls to your heart's content. So that, I find, an absolute phony rationale for this business. It is totally fine to do this business. I'm not saying don't do it. Go for it. However, don't come at this with some kind of like savior mentality as you're here to save golf. That's not the case. That's not what you're here for. You're here to try to make money, and to do so, you see the easiest path forward by partnering with existing golf facilities and signing long-term leases. That's a business strategy. That is not a saving golf strategy. It's totally fine. And longer in the piece, the Deering gentleman who was with Adams Golf at one point and other startups, they're going to do an equity. He says they're going to do a preferred equity raise in 2024 with plans to leverage debt. He says, quote, "We will be able to access debt because of the long-term nature of our lease agreements. Obviously, the more debt we can bring in, the less dilution that will occur. So we're balancing those factors as we determine how much equity to raise." So again, they're still in this kind of, they need money. And the debt market isn't very fun right now. Interest rates are very high. Even if it's long-term debt, those rates are still pretty high. So they're going to have to figure out how much money they and their Deering and DeChambeau and their other co-founders are going to want to bring in versus what they've put in versus debt. And that's going to be, you know, pretty tricky, to be honest. Quite tricky. So good luck to them with the business model. But the whole point of doing this story is trying to call out, and I'm going to say something here. Deering comes with another quote, just saw, I didn't even get to this part yet, about the savior mentality in golf, that we're doing this because of, we're trying to grow the game, or we're trying to make it lower cost, or what have you. That's not the case. No one does that. It doesn't work that way, especially people who get quoted in these regional magazines. Like this quote from Deering says, "We believe our total addressable market is much larger than Topgolf. Topgolf's business model doesn't support the appeal to the avid golfer. We are targeting the low handicappers with our world-class practice facility, whilst also stealing market share from Topgolf with our golf gamification and our celebrity chef-led food and beverage offerings. So if our golf gamification is similar to Topgolf in Westworth Village specifically, we believe that consumers will select us over Topgolf because of the quality, F&B, and the location," end quote. And that's also absolute phony baloney. Their addressable market is not larger than Topgolf's. Topgolf has, what, like 70 or 80 locations, and they're constantly building them. They have planted a flag in most major American markets, if not multiple locations in the same market. So whatever he is spewing here is just no. Just no. It won't. Nope. And it's not going to work out very well for them. But good luck to them. But the whole point of the story was, hey, this phony baloney stuff about saving the game, it's still around. It's something you should be skeptical of. It's okay to make money as a business. There's no problem doing that. I have no problem with that whatsoever. But don't try to come at this as to the golf industry and to the broader public of, we're here to make golf more affordable. We've got plenty of affordable golf, and I would like to promote what we've got already, rather than get private equity and venture capital involved in trying to dress it up and make it a little bit fancier. All right, we're going to go take a break. We'll be back right after this, after a word from our sponsor. If you're like me, you've wanted to buy gold for years. Lots of commercials out there, but who can you really trust? I don't want a bad investment, but didn't want to miss the boat either. Sound familiar? Fortunately, I've got great news. If you have an IRA or 401k and want to buy physical gold, eliminate fear and uncertainty from the process using the new Gold IRA Company Integrity Checklist. It helps you evaluate and choose the best gold IRA company. I used it personally to vet Augusta Precious Metals, and they are absolutely phenomenal. Use this checklist to choose the best gold IRA company. Text to get your free Gold IRA Company Integrity Checklist today. Text GOLF to 68592. Again, text GOLF to 68592. That's GOLF to 68592. Or go to AugustaPreciousMetals.com. All right, so second story today. This is one I was not planning on doing. I was still trying to figure out what the second story of the show was going to be, and then this came into my timeline on X from Josh Carpenter, who works at Sports Business Journal, and he has there's a good number of scoops about the golf business world, because that is his beat after all. I want to give him credit for this. It's a good story. The story is that the LPGA will be adding a new tournament next year in the Boston, New England area. It's going to start at TPC Boston next year. It'll be called the FM Global Championship. It's got a 5-year tournament commitment from this commercial insurance firm, which is called FM Global. I've not heard of them. Maybe you have, but I also don't work in the commercial insurance industry. The purse will be $3.5 million, which will be the highest non-major or tour championship purse. And they will jack up the prize money by $300,000 each year, starting with the second year of the tournament. So you're going to have four raises. So at the end of this contract, the tournament will be $4.7 million in terms of a purse. This is a pretty significant deal for the LPGA. This is the first tournament sponsorship negotiated as part of their partnership with Fenway Sports Management. Fenway Sports Management is one of those private equity firms / sports investment firms. They own a Premier League team. They bought a TGL franchise. They are rumored to be one of the groups that has submitted a RFP proposal to take some kind of equity stake in the PGA Tour for-profit company that may or may not come along with or without the Saudis. So they have really come into the game here, and they've landed something pretty quickly. Now, you might imagine something like this would happen right out the gate, right? They are based in the New England part of the world, so an event in New England kind of makes a whole lot of sense, right? And that's cool. Good for them. The event's going to start at TPC Boston. It's going to be around the end of August. It'll be August 26th through September 1st will be the tournament week. So it'll be August 29th through September 1st for the actual tournament days. And they expect it to move around throughout New England over the course of 4 years. Part of this might lead into the arrangement between the LPGA and the PGA Tour. I assume the LPGA will get very favorable, if not outright free, access to TPC Boston, because that's one of the benefits of the TPC network for the tour. They don't have to pay to lease their own course when they want to have an event there. So that's why they like the TPCs. However, for it to be able to move around, at least you can get it off the ground in year one. You can get kind of build it up a little bit, and then you can go find other venues as a traveling tournament, which I really like. I know that there are plenty of tournaments out there that are fantastic because they come to the same place every year, and people love that. But I also do like a good tournament that moves around. And to have one in New England that can move around is a great idea. You have a fairly large region, fairly sizable population, a variety of different courses. I think that's a great thing. And I think there is an inflection moment happening here on the LPGA and with women's sports more broadly. And that inflection is that the valuation of women's sports is starting to creep up. And I don't mean just creep up. I mean rocket ship up. It's starting to it's been creeping up. Now it's going to rocket ship. And part of the reason for that is the barrier to entry that we just talked about with Bryson being funny. We use that phrase again here because the barrier to entry to investing in women's sports, either at an ownership level or at a sponsorship level, is still significantly lower than it is to get into male-dominated sports, right? If you want to go own an NFL team, that'll be $6 to $7 billion, please. If you want to own an NBA team, that'll be $2 to $4 billion, please. If you want to own a Major League Soccer franchise, that'll be $750 million, please. That's there are enough billionaires to keep that going, but in terms of ownership for a variety of people that might be interested in having smaller stakes, that they're either totally shut out of that process or they get next to nothing. You can go into tournament ownership of the LPGA. Tournament ownership is a tough thing to do, but in terms of sponsorship investment, you can get in the LPGA for one-third the cost that it is to get involved with the PGA Tour. And you can really do a lot of personal business that you could still do at a PGA Tour event for way less money. You can invest in the WNBA and become an owner. Although just a few years ago, the Las Vegas Aces were worth a couple $1 million in terms of buying that team for the WNBA. Now the new franchise that's going to come to the Golden State Warriors ownership group in the San Francisco area, that was like $50 or $60 million. So that's gone up dramatically. The NWSL, National Women's Soccer League, has had a couple of near-death, if not, you know, doing chest compressions experiences in their life as a league. Now new franchises are worth $40, $50, $60 million. So all of a sudden, you've kind of got this moment where you've got women's sports that are starting to increase in value for a couple of different reasons. One, people are starting to pay attention to them. WNBA ratings have been great the last few years, and the ratings for the finals this year were fantastic. The NWSL's ratings, they're getting on network TV. CBS Sports is really committed to that. They've seen the value of that and the value of ratings. You've got better ratings at times for the LPGA, especially as they get more network TV time. You know, Golf Channel, no offense to Golf Channel, but you're only going to attract a certain audience on Golf Channel. When you get that network TV time, the LPGA has done well. They've gotten into that seven-figure range of viewers. So that's been coming up. So this is kind of an interesting inflection point because the LPGA went through this basically 20 years ago when Ty Votaw was the commissioner, and it kind of led into Carolyn Bivens. But Ty Votaw was like, look, we have all these tournaments in all of these very small markets for low prices of sponsorship, and we need to consolidate the schedule. Instead of having 45 events where we're playing for relatively low prize money, we need to consolidate the schedule and give you, the golfer, give you, the professional, an opportunity to make a decent living without having to put on an incredible amount of miles, even above and beyond what they do now, which is still pretty crazy. It was even crazier then. I have the 2007 LPGA media guide here on my office shelf, and I want to kind of read to you some of the places they played for how much they played for 16 years ago. So, yeah, a couple of events in Hawaii for $1.1 and $1.2 million. The Kraft Nabisco Championship purse was $2 million. The Ginn Open, remember the Ginn, which was like this property scheme that turned out to be a terrible thing. That was like the high water line, $2.6 million for a regular season tournament. And then you have the U.S. Women's Open was worth $3.1 million. The Women's British Open was worth $2 million. The Evian Masters, which wasn't a major yet, was $3 million. But toward the back end of the season, you had a lot of tournaments with sub-million-dollar purses. And the tournaments that were overseas in Asia, they're actually not that different in terms of prize money. Maybe not quite double, you know, 60, 70% higher. This kind of change in the schedule, this really represented the, we're going to ditch all of the small town events. All the events that were like $5,000 and $750,000 purses. You're out the door. We're only doing seven figures, baby. And we're kind of at that point again. Molly Marcos-Salmon, who is the LPGA commissioner, has said any new tournament that comes on the schedule needs a minimum of a $3 million purse, and that they're going to try and make the minimum purse basically on any event $2 million. So if you've been with the tour for a while, you're kind of grandfathered into this. But once they cycle that group of sponsors out or encourage them to get up to that $3 million minimum, that's where the LPGA is going to be. So in the space of 16 years, the LPGA went from a schedule where, you know, $40 million was, $50 million was a lot of money. They're well over $100 million. And next year, it's probably going to be closer to $110 million. The purses are going up pretty quickly. And now the next stage for them, a lot of that was instigated by the major championships, kind of had an arms race toward $10 million purses for all the majors. And now we're going to be in a position where I think some of the new sponsors for these events are going to come in this wave. Maybe, who knows what will happen with the American economy. Will there be a recession? Will there be a slowdown? We just had numbers that said almost 5% growth in the third quarter despite everything going on. So I don't know where we're going here, but it sure seems like from the economics of the LPGA standpoint, they're going to have more events like this where you get guaranteed increases written into the contract that are not like $100,000, but like $250,000, $300,000 per year. Not 2 and 3 year deals. We want 5 year deals. Those things are going to start to change, and that may lead to better health for the LPGA. And hopefully there are more events like this that come along. The LPGA seems in a very good place right now in terms of the economics of it, star quality, all that's there. So I think they're riding the wave just as much as other women's leagues are right now, and it's good to see. All right, it's going to do it for us today. On two at the first, going to do it for us for this entire week. Hope you enjoy the week of shows. We'll be back next week with some more. We will do even a Halloween show on the 31st. So if you're taking your kids out for trick-or-treat, maybe you save that episode for while you're walking around the neighborhood and watching them knock on doors like a maniac. But either way, however you're listening to the show, I very much appreciate it. We'll be back next week with more. I'm Ryan Ballingy. You can get a hold of me on Twitter or X or Threads or Instagram at Ryan Ballingy. You can email me, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com. Happy to hear from you and talk about anything we talk about on this show, golf, life, whatever. Looking forward to hearing from you. We'll talk to you next week. Thanks for listening to Two Off the First.